Good afternoon, everyone. This is Danny Haifong. You are tuned in to another Left Lens live stream. Please let me know how I sound. I've been on the quiet side. There's something going on with my audio. I'm in a new place, but I don't think that's it. So please do let me know how I'm doing, if I'm like screaming for no reason. But let me know in the chat. But I have a really, I mean, we're talking about something really important today, so I'm excited, and I also am excited to bring on the guest that I have on for today. We're going to be talking about the NATO summit, the BRICS summit. It's been quite the week in geopolitics. It's been quite the week in just international relations, and there's been so much going on. So we're going to talk about all of this with Carlos Martinez. He's the co-editor of Friends of Socialist China. He is also on Twitter at Agent of Change, journalist, writer, activist, and here he is now. Hi, Carlos. How are you?
Hey, Danny. How are you getting on? Yeah, I'm very well. Thank you.
Good, good, good. So again, let me know in the chat how I sound, everybody. But let's talk about first liking the stream, subscribing to the channel, do all of that good stuff while you're coming on. And be sure, of course, to support this channel at patreon.com/DannyHaiFong. Okay, so let's talk about what's been happening over the last week. There's so much that's going on. Of course, the NATO summit happened over this past weekend. We have the new strategic concept that's come out from NATO, targeting now a new target in the Pacific, and no surprise here, it's China. And we also have NATO announcing a whole bunch of moves before and during the summit. You have Finland and Sweden. They are now going to become NATO members after Turkey briefly, very briefly, vetoed this move. But they have come to an agreement, and it looks like that's going to be something that happens pretty rapidly in the coming days and weeks. And then you also have NATO announcing that it is expanding its readiness force to 300,000 from 40,000 troops. So it's been quite the week for NATO. But the week before the summit, we also had the BRICS summit, and the Western media completely blocked out the BRICS summit. There was not a single story on the summit itself. I think there was a couple of articles before the summit about how Russia was being a focus, or it's regaining a place on the international stage, a respectable place on the international stage at the summit. But there's nothing on the summit. So I wanted to talk to you, Carlos, because you wrote about the significance of this year's BRICS summit, or this latest BRICS summit. And, you know, I know you've been following NATO's machinations quite closely, especially since this special military operation in Ukraine that's being conducted by Russia. What are your reactions to all of these moves? And we can just begin there and then have a conversation about it.
Sure. Well, first things first, you know, maybe most importantly, happy 101st birthday to the Communist Party of China, which I would contend is the world's largest and most successful political party, and, you know, an organization that is, broadly speaking, indispensable to the uplift of not just the Chinese people, but also, I would say, you know, the global communist movement, certainly, and broader than that, the progressive movement of humanity for a brighter future. So the summits, yeah, as you say, a fascinating week or 2 weeks in geopolitics, and an escalation that's gone in two directions. On the one hand, you've got NATO and the G7 led, you know, this is essentially the imperialist bloc led by the US, which is escalating the new Cold War, escalating its aggression, escalating what is essentially the project for a new American century, escalating, you know, taking forward Donald Trump's Make America Great Again foreign policy, militarizing, threatening, bullying. So, you know, what's come out of the NATO summit, you know, the major theme, obviously, is ramping up the war in Europe. And what's abundantly clear, the clearest theme of any from this NATO summit and from the last few months, the last 4 or 5 months of diplomatic activity related to the crisis in Ukraine is that the US and its allies do not want peace. You know, you don't hear a word from them about what can be done to negotiate a solution to this crisis in Ukraine. You don't hear a word from them about how they can resolve it, how they can bring about peace. They want to prolong the crisis. They're thinking, they're looking back to the 1980s, they're looking back to Afghanistan and think and how the State Department and the CIA were able to gradually ramp up against the Soviet Union. They were able to gradually supply more and more arms, more and more finance to the Mujahideen in order to exhaust the Soviet armed forces and to bring about this kind of protracted, you know, 10-year war, which had some impact. That was part of the reason for the collapse of the Soviet Union. Not the only one, but part of the reason. So if the US was in the slightest bit interested in ending tensions in Ukraine, in establishing a stable peace in Europe, it could have facilitated that, right? You know, that's been the case for at least the last 8 years, so, you know, since the Maidan coup, which was very much encouraged, very strongly financed and encouraged from Washington. They could have encouraged the Kiev government to implement the Minsk agreements, right? They could have encouraged or at least accepted that a federal solution for Donbass would have been on the table, but they didn't do that. You know, they've constantly gone for a maximalist program of Ukraine becoming a part of NATO and becoming this permanent base for US hegemony in Europe and for threatening Russia. You know, and that's how the whole question of national oppression of Donbass people became like a globally important issue, you know, became a question of geostrategic significance. You know, that's the whole basis for this tactical alliance that you've got in place now between, on the one hand, the US, on the other hand, Western Europe, on the other hand, you know, the supposed, you know, the Western Ukrainian, the supposed kind of Europhile liberals in Kiev and Lvov, and then, you know, the so-called ultra-nationalists, i.e. fascists, who are actually kind of doing the hard work of you know, brutally oppressing and murdering people, you know, ethno-linguistically Russian people in Ukraine. So it's so clear that the US does not want peace in Europe. It's so clear that the US wants to prolong this war, and that's why they've successfully been able to persuade Europe to implement unprecedented and illegal sanctions against Russia and Belarus. It's why they've been able to persuade them to increase their spending, increase their contributions to NATO, increase their military spending, increase, you know, their troop deployment in Eastern Europe. So, you know, if we'll talk about BRICS later, but, you know, if the theme of BRICS is peace and multipolarity, then the theme of the NATO summit is war and hegemony.
Yeah. Yeah. And then that was quite clear in just how the United States and NATO connected themselves. And this came right after the G7 met, I believe. And I think it's a good time to get into just how coordinated all of this is. You had the G7 right before the NATO summit come together and say, oh, we're going to counter China's Belt and Road Initiative by throwing, what was it, $600 billion or so U.S. dollars, which China achieved. China had spent that much on the Belt and Road Initiative 3 years by 2019. And now the expenditures are now in the trillions, and China is well ahead in terms of its, in terms of its leadership in infrastructure development. But obviously, the G7 countries, this group of imperialists, felt like they had to do something about China. And China seems to be a recurring theme here, because during the NATO summit, for the first time ever, China has become a focus of NATO. In NATO, I'm going to pull it up, actually, because I think it's important to read exactly what the strategic concept says about China, because I think it really gives us a good picture of what they're thinking. So here it is. Here's the NATO 2022 strategic concept. They haven't updated this for 10 years, this so-called strategy of NATO. And so I'm going to go to point number 13, because that's where they really mention China here. And it says, the People's Republic of China's stated ambitions and coercive policies challenge our interests, securities, and values. The People's Republic of China employs a broad range of political, economic, and military tools to increase its global footprint and project power while remaining opaque about its strategy, intentions, and military buildup. The PRC's malicious hybrid and cyber operations and its confrontational rhetoric and disinformation target allies and harm alliance security. The PRC seeks to control key technological industrial sectors, critical infrastructure, and strategic materials and supply chains. It uses its economic leverage to create strategic dependencies and enhance its influence. It strives to subvert the rules-based international order, including in the space, cyber, and maritime domains. The deepening strategic partnership between the People's Republic of China and the Russian Federation and their mutual reinforcing attempts to undercut the rules-based international order run counter to our values and interests. And then right after that, it's almost like speaking out of two sides of your mouth, they say we remain open to constructive engagement with China. So it's pretty clear that China is a big worry for NATO at this time. My first impression was this sounds like it was written by the United States. I mean, it just, you could just hear all of the talking points from Antony Blinken, from the Biden administration throughout its whole tenure thus far, rules-based international order, right? All of these terms thrown out to paint China as a threat. And this is, I think, significant because now it shows that Europe, these European countries, which make up the vast majority of NATO, have signed on with very little, if not any, challenge. What's your reaction to this, to what NATO is saying about China? Because it feels to me that you could just plug in the United States instead of China and all of that would be true to some degree or another.
Yeah, well, I mean, you and I certainly both know, because we're both founder members of No Cold War, which was launched a couple of years ago. And, we've been watching since I guess 2011 with the pivot to Asia, in the Obama administration, which was authored by Hillary Clinton, and then through the Trump's major escalation against China, the launching of the trade war, the revival of the Quad, and then with Biden, the introduction of AUKUS, this so-called trilateral security pact in the Pacific between Australia, Britain, and the US, essentially a kind of white empire nostalgia club. But the real nature of which is essentially a nuclear submarine agreement, a deal to provide the Australia with nuclear enabled submarines, which is in a fairly clear violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. So we've been seeing this, constant escalation against China over the course of at least a decade, but particularly in the last 3-4 years. And obviously the pandemic comes into that, and the sloping of the shoulders and the attempts to shift the blame for the pandemic onto China, which, as we both know, has been able to suppress and handle the pandemic with a just unbelievable level of competence and humanity and efficiency. The death rate is like 800 times less than that of Britain or the US. But the fact that it was first detected in Wuhan obviously gave American imperialism the opportunity to say that this was all China's fault. You've got the Biden administration still putting out the lab leak theory in spite of the fact that it's thoroughly debunked. But the escalation of China against China is sort of almost inevitable. If your starting point is that the core strategy of the US ruling class is to continue its program of domination, is to continue the project for a new American century, which is, but that's a, an expression and a label that came from the George W. Bush administration, and it's associated with the likes of Rumsfeld. But it's really a constant, you know, it's you see that in the George W. Bush administration, in the Obama administration, in the Trump administration, and in the Biden administration. You know, Biden was supposed to be this great progressive. I mean, speaking as someone that's not in the United States, Biden's foreign policy looks extremely similar to that of Donald J. Trump. The only real difference that I can see actually is that Biden's quite a lot more effective. You know, Biden does a better job of pursuing Trumpian policy than Trump did. But China is kind of the obvious enemy, right? US imperialism has to have an enemy, and China's the obvious number one choice. And this is a long-term, you know, this is a long-term strategic project going back to 1949, going back to the Chinese Revolution. You know, how did the US respond? How did the Truman administration respond to the Chinese Revolution? Did they say, okay, the Chinese people have stood up and they've decided to pursue the path of socialism, and, you know, let's deal with them on the basis of equality and respect and dignity, and let's see what we can do. Let's enjoy peaceful coexistence is an expression that was doing the rounds a lot, at least in the socialist world at the time. No, they didn't. You know, they launched the Korean War, you know, a major part of the motivation for which was attacking China and rolling back the Chinese Revolution. They deployed the Seventh Fleet to the Taiwan Straits to prevent China from reincorporating Taiwan into the People's Republic. So, you know, that's really been a constant. And now China, what's changed compared to 5 years ago or 10 years ago or 15 years ago is, more than anything, China's strong. You know, China's a strong country now. You know, depending on how you measure it, China is either the largest economy in the world or the second largest economy of the world. So that's basically, you know, whether you go on GDP or purchasing power parity. China is, you know, leading the way in terms of the battle against climate breakdown, in terms of renewable energy. It's obviously led the way in terms of tackling the pandemic. It's had these incredible successes against poverty. It's the largest trading partner of at least 2/3 of the world countries. The Belt and Road Initiative already incorporates 140 countries around the world out of 200. So if you look at the developing world, if you look at the Caribbean, if you look at Africa, if you look at Latin America, if you look at Southeast Asia, Central Asia, nearly all of these countries are signed up to the Belt and Road. So, you know, China's kind of constructing this multipolar world around, you know, around the imperialist, you know, hegemonic group, you know, led by the US, or what Samir Amin referred to as the triad, right? He talked about the North America, Western Europe, and Japan as being the triad of the global imperialist system. So China's been very successfully and quite quietly and very effectively building this multipolar framework that's rooted in the international institutions, it's rooted in the UN, it's respectful of international law, it's respectful of the UN Charter, but it runs directly counter to the interests of imperialism and hegemony. And the fact that this new Cold War is being escalated to the extent that it is obviously a reflection that China's been very successful.
Yeah. Yeah. And it also is a reflection of how the United States has made it quite clear under Biden. I mean, you mentioned Biden's foreign policy being more effective than Trump's. We at Black Agenda Report have maintained that the Democrats have been a more effective evil in all realms, but foreign policy, most definitely, for quite some time. But I think also what Biden's escalations against China also reflect through NATO, through the G7, these are all U.S. dominated institutions. They're just a reflection. They're just an extension and a reflection of its interests, of the American empire. They're not independent bodies. It's really misleading to even frame them that way, as they're often talked about in the mainstream Western media. But I think what we're seeing is how there's a divergent path between China and the United States. And of course, the kind of, I wouldn't say camps, but in terms of where countries like Russia and other countries close to China who prefer trade, it's becoming most of the so-called developing world, most of the global South at this point, which would prefer to connect with China rather than disconnect from the world and be just merely puppets of the United States. Not a very attractive venture at this point, but I think what we see from the BRICS versus the BRICS summit, and then you had G7, right? And you had two completely different, a completely different orientation to things. And then you had the NATO summit, which was just icing on the cake, which just poured more gasoline onto, I mean, NATO came out and said, yeah, Russia is our biggest enemy, and we're all about basically destroying Russia. We're all about ensuring that we're safe from Russia, and we're going to do everything we can to weaken Russia. And then, oh yeah, China's over here. China's the next, it's almost like China, that's the next kind of objective. I mean, we've had defense officials, so-called diplomats say this for a while about, okay, well, we can't fight Russia and China at the same time, but we're going to make sure we prioritize both at some level at all times. And that seems like what's happening. And I think the BRICS summit, we can get into this now, the BRICS summit really is a reflection, I think, of this entire trend where you have China and its biggest partner, Russia, but then you have countries like Brazil, which is under a right-wing administration, has not pulled out of BRICS. I think that was one of the hopes that the United States and West had, was that it would pull out of all of the China-led multilateral institutions, but it has not. South Africa, and you have India. So these are very interesting countries, huge countries. They make up, I think, some 30% of global GDP, and that's only because GDP, nominal GDP, is pretty limited. If we were to take purchasing power parity, it would blow the rest of the world out of the water in terms of how much these economies matter. So yeah, could you speak about this divergent trend? Like what BRICS is expanding to? If you could talk about what does BRICS kind of portend for the world? And I mean, if you could talk about what the United States, like, are all of these machinations and policies and maneuvers from the United States and NATO and its allies, are they all geared to stopping such a thing?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of threads to pick up here. I guess one important point you made is that there is this strong divergent trend, that you've got the US and its allies going in one direction, and you've got essentially the rest of the world going in the other direction. One real negative in all of this is, like, you know, if we take the US position as a given, if we say, okay, the US has got its policy, the US wants to maintain its dominance, it wants to maintain the imperialist world system based around, on the one hand, on the financial side, dollar hegemony, and on the military side, well, its whole network of 800 foreign military bases, its bilateral relations with, you know, any number of countries, but like any number of different national armies, its naval exercise and all the rest of it, that, you know, that's a given. We know where the US is at, and that's not really very likely to change. You know, the US imperialist strategy, frankly, isn't going to change until the rest of the world forces it to change. What has been a little bit more up in the air in recent years, particularly, well, especially with since the collapse of the Soviet Union, so throughout the 90s and then particularly in the noughties, is what is the position of Europe in all of this? And I think, you know, Donald Trump would have dearly loved to have, like, really consolidated this US-led imperialist alliance with Europe coming fully on board. And he wasn't entirely successful with that. And Biden thus far has been a lot more successful. And there's a few reasons for that. One, obviously, the Ukraine crisis is a very important variable. The change of government in Germany is something that we don't speak about enough, and which is also important because, you know, Merkel, for all her faults, you know, she was essentially a ruthless imperialist politician, but also she did have some sense of the kind of inevitable nature of a multipolar future, and she did have some sense of the need to have some kind of balance, you know, with Europe in the middle, Russia and China on one side, the US on the other side. And, you know, Merkel, you know, she was part of the CDU, which is by no means a progressive organization, but she grew up in East Germany. She speaks fluent Russian. And, you know, she was just the whole aspect of the whole outlook of German foreign policy under Merkel was, I would argue, significantly different to what you've got now with the Scholz government, which, you know, in paper, in theory at least, should be somewhat more progressive, being an alliance of the Social Democrats and the Greens. But actually, they've, you know, they're essentially, and unfortunately, we're seeing the same now with New Zealand as well, and the putatively progressive and Social Democratic Jacinda Ardern essentially reading off the script that's been printed for them in Washington. And I mean, the German Greens have got a pretty horrific record of supporting whatever imperialist madness is on the table. But that's another discussion. But, you know, what we are seeing is a consolidation of the imperialist bloc, which, you know, which is essentially a negative development. Like, the US has been able to persuade its European allies and its kind of and its Anglo-Saxon allies, you know, Britain, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, to impose unprecedented sanctions on Belarus, unprecedented sanctions on Russia, to ramp up their contributions to NATO. You know, you've got Sweden and Finland seemingly on the verge of joining NATO, breaking what has been a very successful and a perfectly sensible policy of neutrality that they've held for the last 70 years. And all of this is coming at massive cost to ordinary people in Europe. You know, food prices have gone through the roof, energy prices have gone through the roof. And instead of helping their populations out, these governments are just ramping up their military expenditure, not to mention, you know, providing extraordinary amounts of money and extraordinary numbers of weapons to Ukraine. And, you know, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs spokesperson Zhao Lijian said a couple of days ago, he's like, you know, this conflict in Russia, between Russia and Ukraine, it's taken this heavy toll in Europe, but the US is benefiting from it. He's like, you've got the US arms dealers popping champagne and the energy industry making exorbitant profits. You know, like cutting out Russian natural gas in Europe, that's a disaster economically, and it's also a disaster environmentally. You know, Germany's bringing its coal mines back on stream. Coal emits at least twice as much carbon dioxide as natural gas does. Meanwhile, you've got US fracking companies. They're ramping up their production of shale gas, which is something that Biden incidentally promised that he'd crack down on. And then transporting it, you know, you have to transport natural gas. You have to liquefy it. You need to store it at minus 80 degrees centigrade or something like that. You can just imagine the environmental cost of that process and then transporting it over the Atlantic. You know, so much for Biden being the climate president. So you have got, you've got this divergence, and you've got the positive side of it that we'll talk about a bit more shortly, which is like global South unity, developing world unity, non-aligned unity. You know, we've got I would argue an inevitable trajectory towards multipolarity. But on the other hand, the US has been able to strengthen its hand somewhat with, you know, consolidating this alliance that includes basically all of Western Europe and all of the kind of the Anglosphere.
Yeah, it's predictable too, because despite the G7's attempts to invest, or they say they're going to invest $600 billion in some kind of Western-led Belt and Road, some kind of Western-led infrastructure, we know the trend over the last 2.5 generations, and that is any kind of, most of this investment generally just ends up in the hands of big financial monopolies, big contractors of some kind, and they do what they want with it, which is usually not much, you know, or that money just is not at all, you know, these promises are not at all implemented. This is not the first time that the United States or US-led institution has made promises to compete with China in this kind of way. This has happened throughout the Biden administration. The whole Biden administration has been, we're going to outcompete China by reinvesting at home. And workers and poor people in the United States are looking around saying, well, couldn't even get the Build Back Better legislation, which had all of the even just the modest environmental infrastructure development measures. That's not going anywhere. And the Biden administration seems pretty fine with that, to be honest. So we know that despite all of this, it was pretty predictable that the United States, that NATO, given the current situation globally, I mean, Russia's special military operation changed everything, of course, because it was the first time in this new Cold War where there really was this kind of breaking point that occurred. And NATO has attempted, the United States and NATO have attempted to use it to exploit it for its benefit, because they provoked the damn thing. So, of course, they're going to exploit it for their benefit. So it's pretty predictable, I think, also, because with these divergent paths, if you have nothing to offer economically to the world, especially to countries that have these decades, if not centuries long histories of having adverse relationships with the West, with imperialism, then you're going to have to find ways to maintain hegemony through other means, right? So if you can't hold countries down with economic war, primarily, then you're also going to have to build up the so-called national security state, or in this case, the global security state, because that's really what NATO is. It's a global police state. It's all about enforcing U.S. interests through a so-called military alliance. But all these European countries, and you mentioned Germany, but all of them are really just going along with the United States's geopolitical interests. And so it was predictable, I think, that given the global situation, given China's path, given the attractiveness, I mean, China just has so much to offer to Latin America, to the African continent, to all of Eurasia, for that matter, including Western Europe. I mean, you live in the UK, you know that the UK is missing out on a lot because it decided to follow the United States down the tech war, down the trade war path. So, I mean, it was predictable, but I think it's important to talk about, you mentioned how there's another side to this. It's not just NATO is belligerent and it's escalating. It's escalating because of something, and it's because of a more positive trend that's happening around the world that I don't think people in the West and the United States pay enough attention to, that there is this misconception that China and Russia, to a large extent, that their activities, that their relations with the world are problematic, either just as problematic, or dare I say, there are some who believe they're more problematic, ridiculous in my view. I don't know what reality these people live in, but there is a sort of a strong anti-China and anti-Russia sentiment, which says that, okay, well, NATO's bad, but China and Russia, there's not much hope there. But I think that most of the world would differ. I think most of the world is understanding that there are profound opportunities in going along with a path that China and Russia are leading, which is international law, peace, and development, peaceful development, the right to be able to develop your economies independently without interference from these countries politically, militarily, etc. I think that's a really attractive path, and it seems almost like a modern day struggle for self-determination that we shouldn't be ignoring, and we shouldn't be bastardizing either.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just on this so-called partnership for global infrastructure and investment, you know, I think we should be clear that it's nothing more than a flag flying exercise. I don't think anybody, you know, including President Biden, including, you know, the White House staffers, including the State Department, including the European Union, think that it's anything other than that. You know, no one's got any intention of seriously launching a Belt and Road Initiative alternative because they don't have the means to do it. You know, China's got the finance. It's got the connections with all of these countries in the developing world, the places that need this infrastructure. It's got incredible experience that it's built up over the course of decades, first with building out its own infrastructure and then building out infrastructure, particularly in Central Asia and Southeast Asia, and now Africa and Latin America and the Caribbean. You know, the US, as I commented on social media, like the US can barely keep the lights on at home. You know, you and I in 2019, we met up in New York, in New York City, and we also saw each other in Beijing. And the contrast between those two cities in terms of infrastructure in terms of just how well maintained and how modern and how well organized they are. It couldn't be starker. You know, New York is a wonderful city, don't get me wrong, but it's falling to pieces.
And you came to East Harlem too, which is one of the most, because I was working at the time when you came to see me, and East Harlem is its own, it's just one of many parts of New York City that are just so exemplary of the very trend that you're talking about, the complete and utter devastation of the infrastructure and of really where poor and working class people live.
Yeah, exactly. So if the US can't maintain, if the US can't build some decent roads and build some train networks at home, are you telling me that it's going to build high-speed rail links and renewable energy infrastructure across Asia and Africa and, the Middle East and Latin America and the Caribbean? You're having a laugh. And everybody knows that, The countries of the global south know that. The countries of the global north know that. It's just, a box-checking exercise. It's a thing that we have to say. It's just propaganda. It's anti-China propaganda. It's just a way of saying, don't cooperate with the Chinese. They're going to involve you in a debt trap. They're not going to follow proper environmental standards, et cetera, et cetera. What happened to the Blue Dot Network? That was 3-4 years ago that they launched this great BRI alternative, the Blue Dot Network. No one's ever heard of it since. They've literally done nothing. What happened to Build Back Better World? Disappeared. Just a couple of months ago, they announced the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework. Again, which was supposed to be the big new thing to connect the islands of the Pacific and the Asian continent and US finance. It's gone nowhere. So, this whole thing is a joke, and we don't have to take it seriously. But it sort of fits into this whole narrative that they're really trying to push. Because as you say, as we've been talking about for the last few minutes, that you've got this divergence in the world. And what is the nature of this divergence? We need to explain it. We need to understand it for ourselves. But the imperialists are also trying to explain it. They're trying to come up with a narrative. And what they've settled on is this kind of farce about democracies versus authoritarian states. They could have been honest. They could have said this is about imperialism versus the West. They could have said this is about white supremacy versus the West, because let's face it, if you look at the member countries of the G7, of NATO, of this US-led alliance, 90% of them are majority white countries. And if you look at their enemies, if you look at the BRICS, if you look at the G20, if you look at this emerging multipolar country, 90% of those countries are majority non-white. It feels like that's probably not a coincidence. But of course they're not gonna, the imperialists aren't going to talk about the divergence in the world in terms of imperialism or in terms of the nexus between kind of colonialism, imperialism, and white supremacy. What they're going to talk about is so-called democracy and so-called authoritarian states, which is, it's such a trivial and silly and easily disposed of argument and narrative. The two of us have co-authored an article in International Critical Thought called The Universalization of Liberal Democracy. So, it goes without saying that we don't understand so-called liberal democracy to be the only or the best form of democracy. But even if you go on, if you work within that framework and you say, okay, this is real democracy, having a semi-presidential system, having regular elections, having a multi-party parliament, et cetera, et cetera. Well, in this framework of democratic versus authoritarian, you've got Ukraine in the democratic camp, and you've got Russia and Belarus in the authoritarian camp, and yet those countries have got exactly the same political system. So it clearly must be something different to a difference in political systems, but they can't talk in those terms.
No. And, even some of these dynamics, they're just so clear to see what you described, you have, I think, Argentina and Iran are applying for BRICS membership under the BRICS Plus format. And you have Finland and Sweden applying for NATO, right? So you have this very clear Eurocentric, white imperialist dominated institution on the one hand getting bigger. The club, their club is expanding, so to speak, although they still represent a very small portion of the world's population in NATO. And then with BRICS, you have countries like Iran and like Argentina, no stranger to predatory imperialism, especially in the realm of finance. Of course, we know that Iran has been the target of all sorts of militaristic threats from the United States, from Israel, from all the regional countries that align with the United States. But really, Iran has been devastated by sanctions to the largest degree and has really tried to avoid any kind of conflict with countries that do want belligerent, that do want to conduct belligerent maneuvers against it. So it's just so clear that you have Argentina, which, you know, unfortunately, a lot of its African descendant population was killed and murdered by colonialism and slavery. But still, these are countries in Argentina and Iran, which are non-white. They're countries with a relationship to, they're oppressed countries with relationships to imperialism that date back many decades, if not centuries. And they're joining BRICS. It's pretty obvious to see why, because China has the goods. China is willing, China and Russia are willing to cooperate fairly. They're willing to actually use what they have at their disposal. China, a really robust socialist market economy. Russia, a growing economy, a growing sovereign economy that has a lot of state orientation, which can allow for more coordination around infrastructure development. So these countries have something to offer. The United States has done, this is known here in the United States. It's known in the United Kingdom, but by people themselves in these countries, that their lives haven't improved for the better in many decades, no matter who you are, unless you are in the top 1% of wealth owners or income earners, you are not benefiting from what's going on over the last 2+ generations. And forget the condition of oppressed nationalities and Black people, etc. Forget, you know, that's even worse. But I think these countries like Iran, like Argentina, Latin America, all across the African continent, they've already experienced what it's like to be under predatory international finance. I mean, the IMF and the World Bank have been doing their thing for quite a long time, since arguably the 1980s, in just absolutely not providing exactly what they had promised to be a counter to so-called socialist development, that there would be prosperous capitalism in these countries all across the third world, the so-called third world. Hasn't happened. These countries have only become poor, only more indebted. I mean, Argentina is one of the most indebted countries in Latin America. I mean, this is to Western financial capitalist like vultures. It's like, it's absolutely ridiculous. So it's quite clear, right, where countries should go. And I don't think, and I want to get your comments on this, I don't think this could have happened without a socialist country in the lead. Like, China is a socialist country. And I think that's the biggest reason why the United States has such a problem. If the United States and NATO were working with a truly capitalist country, even if it was a capitalist country that was supposedly competing with them, I feel like the orientation would be different. The approach would be different. You know, I think that the hope that China would become some kind of Western-style democracy, that in the 90s and the 80s, when relations were really becoming close economically, that there was this hope underneath all of that, if we can just get in enough, if we can work that system enough, that we can make a collapse similar to the Soviet Union, just in their different circumstances. Didn't happen. And I think there's an acknowledgement that it isn't going to happen. How are you going to make a country collapse that's eradicated extreme poverty, has probably the most stable government in the world at this time, one of the most popular governments in the world, and is only advancing on all of these key areas that people tend to like? I mean, Carlos, have you been to Cuba? You haven't been to Cuba yet, right? You have been? You haven't? Yeah. So we've both been, we know, like I've been, and although the socialist project is amazing there, the sanctions have really impacted the country and have impacted the socialist project. Like there are concerns about, you know, how do we continue a revolution that is not allowed to advance economically? Vietnam had that same question right after its revolution, after 1975, and then changed course in the 1980s to a more China-like model because of the same issue. How do we, under very impoverished conditions, have socialism and continue to inspire it? In China, there's really not that, you know, even though there is more money around, there's young people. I was talking to someone about this recently. Yeah, there's more money around. There's more young people who want career opportunities and they want, you know, they want individual kind of all of these things that you would associate with Western life, right? Like they want the technology, they want the careers, they want to move up. But a lot of them also want to be in the Communist Party. There's no rejection of the Communist Party, no rejection of socialism whatsoever. And that's huge to be able to provide both of those things in such a chaotic and unstable world with an imperialist system that wants to see you gone. And so I just want to get your reaction to that, you know, as we continue.
Yeah, you know, I think that those are really important points that you make. And well, I mean, first things first, like, you know, let's be clear, you don't have to be socialist for US imperialism to hate you, but it helps, right? You know, Iran isn't socialist. Modern Russia isn't socialist. You know, Guatemala, that suffered regime change from the US in 1954, wasn't socialist. Indonesia, that suffered regime change, you know, financed and assisted by the US in 1965, wasn't socialist. Or Brazil, or even Chile in 1973. So it's you know, it's enough to want to pursue an independent path. It's enough to want to pursue sovereign development and to not be willing to submit to the diktat of capital. It's enough to not be willing to place yourself exclusively within the kind of pro-US, pro-West, pro-imperialist camp and in the anti-socialist, anti-Soviet, anti-China camp. You know, so to be an enemy of US imperialism, you know, that you don't have to, you don't have to tick the socialist box, but that certainly instantly makes you a target if you do. In terms of, you know, how would China be treated if it weren't a socialist country but had had the same level of success and was playing the same type of global role that it is doing? I just think we're kind of talking in counterfactuals and hypotheticals that, to my mind, couldn't really come true. Because I don't think China could have had the level of success, the level of economic progress, the level of kind of influence over the world, like positive influence and engagement with the world and engagement with that process of sovereign development in the global South, etc., if it weren't a socialist country. And you know, as something that you often like to say, and like so much else in life, it comes down to class power. You know, China isn't a capitalist society. China's not a society where the capitalist class is the ruling class and where the interests of the capitalist class and inevitably the short-term interests of the capitalist class are prioritized over everything else. Because, you know, China is a socialist democracy, because China prioritizes the interests of the working class and the peasantry and the intellectuals, because the Chinese Communist Party is the leading force in Chinese society, it's able to operate in just a much more long-term way and a much more strategic way. You know, if the capitalist class were in charge in China, it may well have fitted into a US-led world. You know, it may well have taken some bribes here and there for the sake of being more effectively inserted into the US-led imperialist world system. But that isn't the case. And because of that, China's been able to continue growing. It's been able to continue relying mainly on its own efforts. Yes, opening up. Yes, encouraging foreign investment. Yes, absorbing foreign technology. But at the same time, always fitting those into a sovereign framework and a policy and a strategy based on, you know, the long-term interests of the Chinese people, and ultimately, I would argue, the people of the world.
Yeah, and I mean, your point is definitely correct. I mean, it's not like China hasn't had the experience pre-1949 with what it's like to be entangled in the imperialist world system, or at least in the emerging imperialist world system of the early to mid, and then, of course, to late 19th century onward to the revolution. I mean, it was a century of humiliation, and China was a very weak country, a very poor country. And so definitely, I mean, without that socialist base, I just think about the infrastructure development. Without that state ownership, which is a key facet of socialism in China, socialism with Chinese characteristics, having the commanding heights of the economy, the banks, the transportation systems, the energy systems, the land, having all of that under the control and direction of the state, of a socialist state, is so key to being able to advance in the way that China has. And all of the other countries that have either been ensnared by the U.S.'s imperialist-led, the U.S.'s imperialist-led economic and military aggression, or those countries that have simply tried to copy or both this system, have not been able to achieve the same success. We can just look at the Soviet Union for what happened after the Soviet Union collapsed. One of the poorest countries, it became one of the poorest countries almost overnight, with just absolutely devastating standards of living in just a decade's time. And so without socialism, I think this is just the case for why socialism is the, I think, the superior system in this era in particular, in that it is able to bring the stability, it's able to bring the direction, the planning, and just the overall orientation to all forms of development, economic and political and defense. All of it is all geared not toward the profit of the 1%, the few who are able to privately accumulate and own capital, but it's for the benefit of humanity. And that's what we've seen China be able to pursue. And I think it has been very smart and very correct for all of these countries that are now collaborating with China based on China's model of international relations. It's become a global trend. And I think that's huge in this post-Soviet era, where for the first decade plus, right, all the way into the U.S. invasion of Iraq, the international order, right, the world order, dare we say, we don't want people coming after us for saying the new world order, but the world order was in complete and utter shambles, chaotic and absolutely just so unstable, and so the damage that was done based on the U.S.'s ability to assert its hegemony wherever it saw fit. We can't even get that back. But now you have a dynamic where, yeah, the United States killed a million people in Iraq and destroyed the country. Now you have China going in and saying, okay, we'll help you build 1,000 schools. We'll help you with COVID-19, protecting you COVID-19. And oh yeah, you can be in the Belt and Road Initiative too. So some of that infrastructure that was destroyed by U.S. bombs can not only be rebuilt, but it will be better than it was before, because now we're moving on to a new stage of economic development. So I think this is all good news. It's just, I think we got to get on board. I think we got to get on board out in our parts of the world. But I want to, I know we only have a few minutes left, Carlos, so I want to get your last thoughts, whatever you'd like to add, and or if you have something that you'd like to, to say in addition.
Yeah, well, I completely agree with everything that you just said. And I think it's just connected to that. Our mutual friend Ben Norton made a speech recently, a really important speech at the last Friends of Socialist China webinar, where he's kind of addressing some of the critiques that have been made from the left in relation to this concept of multipolarity. Because some people have said, well, multipolarity is not so great. We had multipolarity before World War One. There were rival imperialist powers. You had Russia, you had the United States, you had Britain, you had France, you had Germany, and they were competing for supremacy, and it didn't bring peace, and it didn't bring balance to the world, and it didn't bring progress to Asia and Africa and Latin America and the Caribbean and so on. So, you know, is it really multipolarity? You know, is multipolarity really the right goal for us to be adopting in terms of what kind of model of international relations we want to see? And Ben made a really important point, which I think is related to what you've been talking about, which is that we're talking about, you know, modern multipolarity is multipolarity with a socialist core. It's not rival imperialist powers. You know, it's not a multipolarity which is driving towards war among people who are competing for control of the world's land and labor and resources. It's a multipolarity which is based on win-win cooperation and opposition to war, opposition to sanctions, opposition to hegemony. And that's a fundamentally different thing. So on that note, as you say, we've only got a few minutes. You know, let's just maybe talk about the BRICS summit, since, you know, we've had a bit of discussion around NATO. You know, to quickly sum it up, I think it was just a showcase of kind of global South unity, of multipolarity, of resistance to hegemony, opposition to Cold War, opposition to sanctions. It was like the opposite of the NATO summit. And that, I think, reflects the nature of BRICS being the opposite to the nature of NATO. NATO is an instrument of hegemony. It's an instrument of domination, of imperialism, of coercion, of war. And BRICS is an instrument of multilateralism, of international law, of upholding the UN Charter, of sovereign development, of this struggle, this kind of generations-old struggle to overcome the legacy of underdevelopment and the obscene inequality that colonialism and imperialism have left us with. So, you know, in that sense, it couldn't be more different to NATO. You know, the NATO countries, what they're talking about, how do we ramp up the new Cold War? How do we attack Russia? And, you know, once we've defeated Russia, or once we've achieved regime change in Russia, how do we then leverage that to attack China? You know, how are we going to maintain our hegemony for another century and more? The BRICS countries are talking about, how do we secure peace? How do we develop fairness and equality in international relations? How do we develop, how do we build prosperity? How do we work together to fight the pandemic or save the planet? You know, I mean, Xi Jinping's speech to the BRICS summit was really important and really interesting. And, you know, it's so clear. He says their first priority is to safeguard world peace. You know, he starts off by saying, I think our world is overshadowed by the dark clouds of a Cold War. And you've got some countries that are trying to, you know, expand military alliances, and they're trying to pursue unilateralism. They're trying to pursue domination. Now, obviously, you know, it'd be undiplomatic for him to talk about, to reference the US and NATO by name. So he says some countries and some military alliances, but we all know what he's talking about. But he's basically saying that BRICS has got an opportunity to be a trailblazer in pursuing win-win cooperation, in rejecting hegemony, rejecting kind of bullying behavior. And the Chinese in particular have really kind of increased their very vocal opposition to sanctions, like unilateral illegal sanctions recently, which is really important because, you know, obviously they're having an effect on Russia. But in terms of the effect that sanctions have had for decades on Iran, which you've mentioned, on Cuba, which you've mentioned, on, you know, Democratic People's Republic of Korea, which has, you know, suffered really awful, suffocating sanctions for decades. So if we can use BRICS to be kind of the center of a global movement against unilateral and illegal sanctions, I think that's a really important role that it can play. You know, so Xi Jinping talks about this new BRICS Vaccine Research and Development Center and how that's the model of the type of cooperation that our countries in the global South can really lead by example on. You know, there's incredible scope for the world to work together on humanity's common problems, right? Pandemics, renewable energy infrastructure, establishing a viable global peace, like ending poverty and, you know, ensuring that there's no more famines in the world. You know, these are the questions that the BRICS and that the global South and non-aligned and broadly speaking, anti-imperialist countries want to take on, want to address. And, you know, the thing that's standing in the way is imperialism, is the US's continued drive to dominate and to maintain itself as a global hegemon. And, you know, on the one hand, economically, diplomatically, you know, things are essentially for the Global South, for China, for BRICS. Things are moving in the right direction, and history is on our side. But, you know, Mao Zedong did say power grows out the barrel of a gun, and the US still continues to be by far, you know, the most fearsome kind of military power the world has ever known. So that continues to be an important variable that, you know, that we need to understand and be cognizant of.
Yes, yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Well, I mean, I think that is a very clear picture and also a real positive one. I think people are starving in our parts of the world for some kind of silver lining for all of this. And I think the ability to explain how, if you have an analysis of class, if you are thinking in terms of class struggle, even among nations, we are seeing, I think, one occur under very particular circumstances, which do point to some real concrete and tangible benefits to humanity, to the future of human development, political development, economic development. And so I think it really behooves us to pay attention to this and then to find a way to plug in so we are on the right side, not just a side, but on the right side, right? Because I think it's kind of easy. I think when you mentioned critiques of multipolarity, it can be really easy to go from that to not choosing a side in what is maybe not being framed at on either side as like an overt conflict. Sometimes the imperialists do say, well, yeah, Russia and China, we're going after them. Yeah, all these countries, they will say that here and there, but they'll also say other things like, no, we still want to work together. But, you know, you'll never hear the countries of China, Russia say, yeah, no, we're totally in this war we're totally in a class war. They wouldn't say that because, as you said, there's diplomacy involved. Globalization has run its course. These are very particular circumstances that are being navigated. But I think we do have to take a side against the aggression, against the obvious imperialist attacks on these countries, because those attacks threaten to, well, I don't think they're going to reverse the gains and reverse this trend. It does threaten to make it all the more difficult for the world to gain the peace, as you mentioned, that's necessary to really have socialism. So for socialists, or if we're for sovereignty, self-determination, if we believe that people have the right to organize their economies and their societies in the way they see fit, then we do have to take a side against that aggression, that imperialism. And we also have to highlight why it's happening. You can't highlight why it's happening without highlighting exactly what you mentioned with the BRICS summit and the overall multipolar trend in the fight for a multipolar world. But Carlos, you know, we're going to be back in touch. We've got a lot to work on. I know please definitely follow Friends of Socialist China in the description. I'm going to stay on for another 30 minutes or so. So please do stick around. But Carlos, is there anything else you'd like to plug before you head out?
So many projects. No, I think you've covered the main things. I just want to say, you know, we're talking about the role of the Global South and the role of the BRICS and these other formations in opposing imperialism and trying to face down that serious threat, particularly the military threat that imperialism carries with it. But, you know, let's also remember that we are revolutionaries, we are communists, we are anti-imperialists in the belly of the beast. And ultimately, the best thing that people in our part of the world can do is to dismantle that system to the extent that we can, or at least weaken that system to the extent that we can from the inside. You know, that's the best favor and the best solidarity that we can show the world.
Most definitely. Well, thanks for joining me. We have a lot of, you mentioned our co-authored article in International Critical Thought. Definitely do check that out. For some reason, I think the link only gives us a limited number to share with people because people are getting paywalled. So I've downloaded the PDF and I can share that with all of you on all the social media that I have, Patreon and Telegram and whatnot. I already have done that. So definitely check it out. But yeah, we're going to be writing new things in the future, and I'm sure we'll be back on together very soon. So thanks for joining, Carlos, and have a good evening out in London.
Same to you. Thank you.
Bye.
See ya.
Yeah, so stick around, everyone. Look, I need more likes in this stream. I noticed that there's about there's a gap, I think, but there's like almost a 20 viewer to like gap ratio, meaning that there's like 20 more people on than there are likes to the stream. So I want to see everyone who's viewing this liking the stream, helping to boost the algorithm. Thanks everyone for coming back on. So I'm going to talk for another 20-30 minutes, some housekeeping things, as well as I'll just give some more commentary. So a really amazing announcement. This week, I was able on Patreon to reach my goal for the year. Unfortunately, now I'm $20 short because this is the first of the month. People are moving on. But even just reaching it for a brief moment helps me get to that goal in the future much more easily. So thanks, everyone. I appreciate it. Please do continue to support this work, though. Patreon.com/DannyHaiFong. People are making a lot of tough economic decisions, I know, but all of it goes to this work and for all that it takes. I'm having some tech issues, so I'm going to have to buy or figure out probably some of this technology stuff. So all of it goes toward that, as well as just the labor involved in doing this work. So patreon.com/DannyHaiFong. I'm now about $20 short and maybe a little bit more short than that by the end of today. It's the first of the month. People are making their decisions, but I really appreciate all your support nonetheless. Okay. But with that said too, after this at 2:30 PM Eastern, I will be on call-in. You can find that link in the description. I'm going to take about a half hour lunch break, and then I'll be on for another 45 minutes to an hour taking live calls. Let's talk. I would love to talk about the NATO summit even more there. So please do join me. You can find the link in the description. Make sure you download the app. Last thing I want to ask is if in the chat, how has my audio been? Is it loud enough? Do I sound quiet? And that's the last logistical thing. So call in, of course, Patreon, of course, liking the stream, of course. And then please tell me about the audio, okay? So that was a great conversation. Carlos and I are very close. We work on Friends of Socialist China together, and we will continue to write. We have some ideas. I think we're going to try to do an edited book together on the new Cold War. You know, we want to write another. We've written one academic article together. We've written a couple for International Critical Thought individually, but, you know, really working together to get those out in that journal, which is a Chinese Academy of Social Science journal. And you know, we've been organizing the events for Friends of Socialist China together, so we'll be doing more work and talks together, I am sure. So that was a great conversation, and thank you. I'm sorry I'm talking so loud. Some people are saying it's normal, everything's good. Thank you. So people are saying they can't super chat for some reason. I'm just going to put a big teals here. I'm $20 away from my goal per month, $20 per month. So please do help out there. So I just wanted to close out, right, the last 20 minutes or so. If you have any questions, please do put them in. Thank you, Big Teal, for always championing. Thank you, thank you, thank you. But I want to talk about, while I still have you here, I want to talk about this week, right, in the context of what I talked about with Richard Wolff, because they're connected. Right as Wall Street investors started to sound the alarm about inflation and say, we need to tank the economy. So that's what the Federal Reserve is doing. Right after the Roe v. Wade, and now the whole Roe v. Wade and all of this kind of domestic unrest happening in the United States, although it's very low, it's very tempered. I wouldn't say I'm disappointed, because I have no confidence in the liberal class to be able to organize any damn thing. And I don't think radical revolutionary socialist forces are strong enough to really fight back. They're not coherent enough yet to fight back in any sort of way. And I don't think Roe v. Wade, as legitimate and as much as I am a supporter of abortion rights, as much as I am all for the liberation of women, queer people, trans people, et cetera, et cetera. That is all interconnected and tied to class struggle, to anti-imperialist struggle, to the struggle against white supremacy and the state. So if they're not all connected, which only certain sections of the political movements in the, you know, around these issues are, then you're going to have a lot of weakness. And I think that's where we're still navigating. So, of course, I would never say I'm against abortion rights or I'm against any of that. You know, I think we should not be going accelerationist here, but we should also understand that there is a reason why the resistance right now is weak. A lot of that has to do with the Democratic Party, and a lot of it has to do with the ways in which these movements are manipulated and are being directed to a large extent by ruling class forces, making those genuine forces, right, all across the movement spectrum in the United States, Black Lives Matter, the movement for trans rights, for queer rights, to oppose oppression on that basis. You know, it really does make the waters murky, and it harms the genuine forces trying to figure things out. It makes it harder for them, makes it harder for us to promote all of that and to strengthen it. So I want to talk about the NATO summit in the context of all of this is what's happening, because I think what we're seeing with the NATO summit is a real crisis, a real general crisis of imperialism. And imagine, right? And we don't have to imagine it, because I think it's coming. An economic crisis under the Biden administration during Russia's special military operation in Ukraine and after NATO has just expanded. I mean, it really is a full picture of the dangers of an imperialist world system in a general crisis, meaning that, yes, the capitalist economic base is in crisis. There is a crisis of underconsumption, of overproduction. There is that crisis kind of always happening at this point at some level, economic stagnation at best, economic collapse at worst. And so with that, you have this massive escalation of militarism. You have Finland and Sweden joining NATO now as the special military operation occurs. Dmitry Medvedev, the former president of Russia, still maintains a prominent place in the United Russia Party, has said that if Sweden and Finland join NATO, that there will be nuclear weapons put on Russia's border as a mechanism of self-defense. So Russia is saying this is a red line. This is more than a red line. This is a red line that's on fire, that's exploding. Ukraine was a red line. This is red line times two, times five. This is an absolute, and we don't have any resistance to it, not within the state, not within the ruling class, and not even in the so-called progressive forces, left forces, not any real resistance. It's not a huge issue. But the Biden administration, I think it's pretty clear, is the most effective evil that imperialism could have right at this moment, because while Biden represents this really, I think, decrepit state of imperialism at the political level, he also will do whatever the imperialists want, whatever the capitalists want. He is going to do it. So he is the best that they could get at this moment, and his legacy and his history helps legitimize him in the eyes of course, the milquetoast imperial left and liberals who just go along with the Democratic Party. So he has been a boon for the ruling class, for imperialism. And the NATO summit just shows how effective Biden has been at this level. This is not to say that Biden is effective. No, this is to say that just his mere presence allows for things to happen that could not happen under Donald Trump or George W. Bush, whatever. You can rehabilitate George W. Bush all you want, but there isn't, right? George W. Bush was able to invade two countries because of an absolute domestic crisis through 9/11. But Joe Biden is not under any kind of crisis like this, but yet he has escalated with Russia through Ukraine to a level that I don't think a Republican could achieve right now, because, well, Republicans just are not as respected. I mean, they're not as respected. Look at how Trump had to maneuver his foreign policy. Very militaristic on some ways, but in other ways, he had to almost go to the left of the Democrats just to exist in the political realm. I mean, it's an absolutely wonky time, a wild time, but I think we have to look at how there is this general crisis of this system that is not going to let up, and none of these moves are going to make it better. We know that the infrastructure spending is not going to happen. That was flag waving, as Carlos said. There's going to be no G7 infrastructure development. All of these countries have predatory financial systems. They're all a part of the international financial system, leaders in it. They are all about indebting countries, stripping them, plundering them to pad the profits of monopolies and the big banks. That's all they're about. So we're not going to see high-speed rail development in Latin America funded by the G7. Not going to happen. And the renewed investment in NATO, adding China, increasing the readiness forces by almost tenfold. And of course, the Finland and Sweden addition to NATO, which happened before the summit, but it was really a preemptive thing. All of that is really about, I think, one, strengthening this military alliance in the face of what they predict is going to be a trend which cannot be arrested, which is the Russia-China alliance, China's rise, its economic supremacy, its socialist economy. These are things that it can't control, but it wants to destabilize. So it's pouring more into the military-industrial complex. The same goes for Russia. Knows it can't really control its political system right now. Sanctions aren't working. They're not going to work. Putin's very popular. United Russia is very popular. The special military operation is popular, and it's popular all across eastern Ukraine and in Russia. You're not going to get what you want there. So really a lot of this is about doing just what's left. And what's left is kind of scorched earth. And it should be both frightening, but also motivating to really get involved in building a real peace movement, because that's what we need. We don't need more people debating. We don't need more people saying, you know, we don't need more kind of both sidesism and what, you know, all this. We don't need these screeds against whataboutism. We don't need this kind of false equivalency that the left and the West often gives us, right, between Russia, China, and the United States. We don't need any of that. We need a real peace movement. And a real peace movement has to have principles. This is what I said yesterday in the Canadian Foreign Policy Institute event. You need to have principles. And so what are your principles? Where do they stand? And you have to choose a side, because there are principles being implemented on both sides of the equation, whether it's the multipolar trend or whether it's the imperialist trend. So you have to choose a side there. There is no third way, and you can't define it. Right? There is no third way, and you can't define it. There is no third way. Of course, the ultra left communists and the right deviationist liberals and leftists and whoever they are, or anarchists or whatever political, whatever you decide to call yourself. You know, you could pretend that there's a independent path, right? That you can just walk in this world and say, yeah, I'm for full communism. I'm for full anarchism. I'm for neither, nothing. I don't want to be involved in that. It's not good for anybody. So I'm for what I want. Well, then you're going to be walking along a very lonely path, which absolutely will accomplish nothing except strengthen, right? Howard Zinn said this. You can't be neutral in a moving train. You'll strengthen the side of imperialism by taking yourself out of what is a real world struggle right now, a real world geopolitical struggle. So we have to be for peace, and we have to be for what this multipolar trend is providing. And then the independence comes from, well, the multipolar world that's being built, China, Russia, they have no say in what's going on in the United States and the West. They can't be like, especially in this delicate situation, oh, yeah, we want socialism, we want this, we want that, we want you to address this and that. Certainly, they'll comment on the issues, but we can't expect that from them. So that's where the independence comes in. Yeah, we stand on the side of peace, self-determination. We want to see the multipolar world grow. And then we want, of course, X, Y, Z, A, B, C, D, E, F, G from the imperialists. If they can't give it to us, then we're going to construct our own system. That's how this struggle has to go. But we can't get there without an understanding that we need to be building a real peace movement that has principles. It isn't just for abstract concepts like peace. Peace is just an abstraction unless it's rooted in real world conditions. And the real world condition says that NATO is risking nuclear winter now, not just with Russia, but now with China. And I talked about this yesterday at the event at the Canadian Foreign Policy Institute, which was only Facebook streamed, and I hope to get a video copy. But I can share that on Telegram and whatnot after this. So follow me at the Haifong Press on Telegram. But there, I was like, the Taiwan question, and there are so many other aspects to this, but there is lots of flashpoints also for nuclear winter on the aggression toward China's side, in Taiwan being the biggest risk. And we know that all of these alliances, all of this renewed focus on China militarily by the U.S. and its allies are going to target the Taiwan question the hardest, while also militarily encircling China completely and entirely through all the means that it can. But Taiwan is the key question. There is a reason why Taiwan has a $14 billion backlog of weapons transfers from the United States. There's a reason why the Biden administration talks about Taiwan and not, let's say, South Korea, Japan, right? Those countries, Taiwan's not a country either, but those countries, those allies, quote unquote, they have a different function and purpose. Taiwan is a political terrain, right? Not just puppet states following along. No, Taiwan is a political terrain that the United States is always experimenting with. And so we can expect all of this new talk about an Asian NATO and NATO focusing on China, all of this to really redirect toward Taiwan at some point and build up that potential conflict, which would be catastrophic. And it's all of it's going to happen under the auspices of an economic recession. So this is going to be a wild ride, everyone. A wild, wild ride. I mean, imagine if, I mean, the U.S. was entangled in two interventions, right? Direct wars, overt wars in Afghanistan and Iraq during the Bush administration when the 2007-08 crisis started. But they were already 5 to 7, 8, 9 years old at that time. Imagine an economic recession amid Russia's special military operation in Ukraine and the risk of two fronts for nuclear winter happening at the same time. It blows my mind, right? It blows my mind that we're in this moment, right? And we're not prepared. But that's why we're doing this work, everyone. We're getting prepared. We have to be prepared. We have to be in solidarity. We have to build real solidarity. We have to distribute the information. We have to build the organization capable of building a real peace movement. So that's where we're at. And so all that happened in the NATO summit is really a warning. It is the flash that was shot into the sky, right? For all of us to understand just how high the stakes are right now and just how important it is to defend China, defend Russia from imperialism, and defend what they are doing. We have to have a positive peace, not just a passive peace. There is no passive peace. There never has been such a thing. Vladimir Lenin would roll in his grave if he heard people talk like this. There is no passive peace. You have to be for something if you're against something. You have to be both. That's the only way you can have any kind of legitimate political struggle against imperialism that will lead to a transition, a transformation from this order to a decrepit, crisis-ridden, anti-human, anti-worker order to one that is its opposite. That's the only way you get there, to a socialist order. That's the only way you get there. So with that said, everyone, please do continue to like the stream, hit the subscribe button, notifications bell, and of course, please do support this work on Patreon at patreon.com/DannyHaiFong. Now about 20, let's just say it'll be $30 per month away from the goal again after this day is over. It's the beginning of the month and whatnot. I do have a couple of special announcements now. I'm working out with Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz an interview for tomorrow. I'm not going to be able to stream July 4th, but I can stream tomorrow. So I hope to stream with her about July 4th and about her new book, Not a Nation of Immigrants, the relationship between the two. She's been talking about foreign policy too. She did in the book. I was able to read the chapter on Yellow Peril that she has. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz is an incredible pleasure to have even been able to read her books. And I am looking forward to that conversation. That'll be tomorrow, 4 p.m. Eastern. I just got the email for that, so I have to work it out. But please do join us. Then I'm going to respond to her after I'm done here. And I'm going to try to work it out for 4:30 p.m. Eastern. So make sure you're in on that. And I'm going to be on call-in in a short moment, a half hour from now. So please do join me on call-in, because I'm going to be there at 2:30 p.m. Eastern to talk more about the NATO summit and to take your calls. I really want to have a conversation. But I'm really excited about the possibility of having Roxanne Dunbar tomorrow. So be on the lookout. I'll announce it on the community, all of that. I announce it on Patreon, on Twitter. So be there. Okay. With that said though, I don't see any questions or super chats at all. I just wanted to give my final words on the NATO summit and what it means. Cause we have to have the economic crisis in there. We have to understand that this moment is one that is very important to understand. We're in a very interesting moment, everybody. So make sure that we are paying attention. So that's what I wanted to bring to your attention, the economic crisis part of it. With that said, everyone, so we got Colin. Okay, I'm gonna put in my Telegram as well. I want you all to follow me on Telegram if you can. All my Patreon is like paywalled, but it's all public stuff. So if you follow me elsewhere, you'll get it. I do mostly post privately on Patreon to the community, I'm gonna post it in the chat. Here it is. There's my Telegram. I accidentally posted it in the chat on my Telegram, so now I got to explain myself. So follow me on Telegram, and I hope tomorrow to have Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz on with me tomorrow. That'll be fun. Thanks so much, everyone. Happy birthday to the Communist Party of China. Happy July 1st. Of course, July 4th is coming, but we're not celebrating that. Please do, before you go, help me catch up in the like department. Please do sign up for Patreon to support this work. And I will be seeing you again very soon, tomorrow, if it's Roxanne or not, but I'm going to start getting that going now. So peace out, and I will see you hopefully in a half hour on Colin. Bye-bye.